This is the Neurosurgery Podcast.
Welcome back to the Neurosurgery Podcast. Today, I am over the moon delighted with today's guest. It's someone that I've been wanting to have on the show for years, someone who I will shamelessly declare I'm a fan of professionally, and I've been following for my entire time in the field of neurosurgery. Of course, it's Dr. Nicholas Theodore. Dr. Theodore is a titan of spine and neurosurgery in a variety of domains within our field. Today, we're going to focus specifically on some of the work he's done in robotics, in minimally invasive spine surgery, robotics. But of course, I would like to talk to Dr. Theodore about trauma and spinal cord injury and just geek out. But for the sake of our listeners, I'm going to rein myself in today, and we're going to talk about, you know, that other little thing that he's done in his career. But Dr. Theodore, for some of our younger listeners who may not be familiar with you and are just joining the field, please take a moment, say hello, and introduce yourself.
Oh, well, that was a great introduction. I appreciate that. I feel like Joe Rogan being introduced on somebody's podcast. So my name is Nick Theodore. I'm a neurosurgeon, obviously, a professor of neurosurgery, biomedical engineering, and orthopedics at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, have spent the last 25 years trying to build the story of bringing engineering and the field of spinal surgery together, weaving those things together, and then sprinkling in a little bit of trauma and sports and other things. But it's been a great ride, and happy to be here with you this morning.
Phenomenal. Well, like I said, you wear so many hats within our field. Today, we're going to try to focus on that engineering side of things. But before we dive headfirst into that, because we finally have you on the show, and both for me and the curious among our listeners, take a moment and talk about your background. You know, before we got on, you mentioned you spent part of your career in the Navy. Obviously, you've had a storied trajectory within neurosurgery. So for our listeners, where'd you grow up? Where are you from? How did you get into the field? And briefly, what was your professional arc until today?
So I grew up in San Diego, California, actually, and, you know, had a pretty uneventful childhood, played baseball and always interested in the sciences. I attended college at Cornell University and had always had pre-med on the mind, but at that time majored actually in government and was very interested in health-related public policy. And, you know, was given the advice that, you know, major in something outside of sciences because you really don't ever have a chance to go back. So I really felt that was had a great sort of broad background in science and public policy and health stuff. And then ended up in Washington, D.C. For medical school at Georgetown. And at the time, Georgetown was the most expensive medical school in the United States. And like not a small number of my class members joined the Navy and had a scholarship, health profession scholarship to the Navy, which really I think for me was transformational. The things I got to do in the Navy after graduating, I did my internship at Bethesda, then spent some time over in Okinawa, Japan with the Marines, and was always assigned to the Marine side of things, but really developed a very healthy interest in the neurotrauma, knowing that I was going to do neurosurgery, and came back actually and started residency at Bethesda Naval Hospital before it became renamed Walter Reed, and spent the first couple of years there, including 6 months at NIH with Ed Oldfield, and then ended up in Phoenix for a year, supposedly 1 year, to do a fellowship with Volker Sontag in research, actually, spine research. And at the time, ended up being asked to stay, so finished residency and fellowship in Phoenix. Sort of a funny story, which was that when Dr. Spetzler asked me to stay, to finish residency, I called the Navy, and the Navy said, "No, you got to come back. There's no way you can't stay. We own you." And then shortly after that conversation, which was a little demoralizing, Rich Ellenbogen became the chief of the new combined Army-Navy program. And I bumped into him at a meeting in Montreal and told him that Spetzler had asked me to stay, and you're the new combined chairman. And Ellenbogen said, "Spetzler offered you a job? Take it. I'll get you out." So was able to finish residency and fellowship in Phoenix, and then went to San Diego as chief of neurosurgery at the Naval Hospital for a few years, back to Phoenix for 15 years, and then been in Baltimore now for the past 7 years. So it's sort of a, you know, a traveling story.
Well, Nick, thank you for your service. It's inspiring. We've done some episodes in the past on military medicine and neurosurgery, and so many of our leaders like yourself have had a long stint, if you will, inside the armed services. And I think it really helps to galvanize the mind. But today, I know we could talk about so many different things, but JP and I really wanted to focus on engineering. And of course, you are the inventor. Can I say it that way? You are the founder, inventor, the innovator, along with teams of engineers, I'm sure, of the Excelsius robot, the Globus robot. That's correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. And this is such a great project to talk about because so many folks have reached out to us saying, you know, I have great ideas. I'm trying to do this little thing in the corner of neurosurgery. And how do I get inspiration? And you know, success stories like yours are inspiring for young folks. We have an Excelsius here. My partner, Timur Yurikov, uses it for very unusual and spectacular cutting-edge surgeries. And I want to get deeper into the Excelsius, but can you just start by sharing with our listeners a little about the early journey, like when you first came up with the concepts, what you were doing, the difficulties you faced, the challenges you overcame?
Sure. So interestingly, you know, really it's a bit of a story like Outliers and Malcolm Gladwell. It's really sort of the right place at the right time. So in my training at Bethesda, you know, I remember looking at a CT scan or an MRI scan, putting your finger on the patient's head and figuring out where you think the tumor is, and then opening up and then being off a centimeter and being a little demoralized that you didn't hit the mark. And then when I went to Phoenix, it was really the beginning of image-guided cranial surgery, just the first couple of years of frame of the arm, the old ISG arm, which was able to point. And that really changed, I think, the field of neurosurgery forever, where there isn't any more brain surgery being done in any developed countries without the usage of image guidance. And saw that, and then the question was, well, what about the spine? And it really started off, as you remember, very kludgy. And the ability to register in the spine was horribly cumbersome. But I was an early adopter and stuck with it, seeing value in the fact that understanding where we are in three-dimensional space is a benefit, right? Where's the tumor? Where's the pedicle, et cetera? So certainly learned how to do everything open, but also understood and believed in the value of being able to do things in a less invasive manner. And, you know, the next question came of, you know, how do you automate that accuracy? And Neil Crawford, who at the time was the chief of the biomechanics lab at Barrow and is my best friend, is really an unbelievably brilliant biomedical engineer. And probably over the course of 20,000 cups of coffee or more, sketched out really what does it look like. So I told him, I said, you know, Neil, I said, we know where we are in three-dimensional space. I want to automate that. I want to be able to program a robotic arm to bring me to that location utilizing real-time image guidance. That's a math problem. And he says, well, yeah. And really that started it. So this is really almost 25 years ago in the year 2001 when I was chief resident at Barrow. Started drawing pictures of what it would look like. What would a robot look like? And, you know, it's interesting because the, you know, obviously it's always harder than it seems, but, you know, I think one piece of advice is you obviously with anything you need to stick with it. We all, you know, are drawn and torn in so many different ways. It's hard to keep focus. But one of the funny things is, you know, in my bio for the last 25 years, I've always said interest in trauma, minimally invasive and robotics. And I remember 20 years ago, somebody said, what have you ever done in robotics? Well, I hadn't done nothing in robotics, but it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy when you, you keep saying that, you keep writing it down, you keep working that way. But early on, you know, as we started getting some ideas of what things look like and what this device might look like, the Da Vinci had just come out in general surgery. You know, we realized that, well, this is sort of an expensive proposition. And we filed some patents. And I remember going to the board at the Barrow Neurologic Foundation and asking for funding. And the board said, no, we're interested in brain tumors. And I said, okay. And then I left there a little dejected. And the next day, the CEO of the hospital, Linda Hunt, called me and said, oh, this is an interesting project. She said, could this be commercializable? And I said, well, of course it could be. And she said, how much do you need? I go, well, we need $600,000 to build a prototype. And I think probably in the history of medicine, I don't know, any time a CEO of a private hospital gave a private practice neurosurgeon $600,000 to build a robot. And that's what Neil and I did. We sort of outsourced some of the mechanical stuff, but built the prototype for the Excelsius robot in Phoenix. And this is probably 2008 or so.
You know, I often quote Dr. Jack Knightley, who told me a few years ago, one of the sayings from the Navy, as you, another Navy guy, was the six P's of the Navy, that prior planning prevents piss poor performance. And so I think that we have that mindset so often in surgery, how you prepare and prepare and prepare so that the surgery can go as close to your plan as possible. But I have literally zero experience in a workshop with engineers with the inventing side of things, particularly with robotics. And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, much like how when we have a complication or something with a patient doesn't go the way we want it to, you know, we all know how to bounce back from that. Sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's less difficult, but we've all had that experience and bounced back. But when you're in the workshop, when you're trying to invent this machine that you dreamed of, and clearly before your first prototype, after the first prototype, the first thing you put together isn't going to work. You know, Edison said, I found 1,000 ways not to make the light bulb. So putting on your engineering inventor hat, what are the frustrations like with those early steps along the way before you have a working model? And how do you bounce back from that and keep going?
So, you know, really, I think one of the most important things is who you're working with, right? And interestingly, we bring every different skills to the table. And Neil and I were a perfect example. So somebody who was, you know, early in his surgical career, who was doing lots and lots of surgeries and doing 600 cases a year plus at the time. And then somebody who's really a problem solver like Neil. It's interesting, if you ask a surgeon, what do you want? He'll say, well, I want a device that does everything in one piece, and it's handheld, and it's small, and it's sleek. And then the engineer will go to the lab and build something that you would never take into the operating room under any circumstances. It just wouldn't work. And that's where I think the excitement is. It really is an iterative process, in that we started from the ground up. Where does the robot go? How big is it? What's the size of it? And then we literally had cardboard boxes in the operating room, looking and measuring how big it's going to be. Where's the base of it going to be? How long does the arm need to be to span? And really, it's a process of going back and forth. And what I realize is that building the mechanical piece, while that was sort of an exciting piece, and Globus really took the prototype and built it into a product with our help, you know, the reality is a lot of it is, you know, what we're really sort of beholden to is the software. And Neil, you know, happened to also be a brilliant programmer, but, you know, there's nothing like one bug in a 100,000 line code for a robot that will bring everything down and bring you to tears. So it's really bringing all those things together, not just the programming piece, the mechanical engineering piece, but the form factor. So as a surgeon, what I would always say was, I'm never going to use this. If this is too ridiculous, if it's too hard to bring it in the room, to get it set up, to register, I'm done. Because we are all very impatient. So we understand the value of enabling technology, but what kills enabling technology is the part where it's just too hard to use. So we really, from the ground up, tried to build something that was, you know, could be adopted and brought into the operating room with a little hassle.
So Nick, you know, we had the Mazor X with Stealth Edition. We had the Renaissance. We have a Rosa. We have the Mako. You know, we love robots here in Miami, and I've written a lot about it. But one thing I've noticed in the last 3 years is that the Excelsius, your baby, has some unique engineering feature to it, which is that your teams are able to iterate so quickly. And, you know, when the robots first came out, I'll be fully open with this, I felt like the Mazor X was in many ways superior at the outset, right at the acquisition when Medtronic bought it from Mazor, if you will, the company. And, you know, very quickly though, the Excelsius changed, and it changed, it seemed like every 3 months. And it wasn't just the software updates. There were some pretty dramatic changes in the platform, the interface, its performance characteristics, accuracy, and without spilling the beans on your trade secrets, how are you able to iterate this so quickly? I mean, it's from an engineering perspective, it is shocking to me, especially given FDA regulation, as you said, the millions of lines of code, right? Everything you do has unintended consequences inside of a robotics operating system, right? How did you guys do this?
So, you know, that's a great question, Mike. So the grand design at the very beginning, but when Neil and I were first started working with this, I said, I want to be able to put a pedicle screw in. That's what I want to do. That's the focus of the project. However, I realized that you can put a catheter in the brain or a deep brain stimulator in. You can do a biopsy in the brain or the spine. You could do kyphoplasty. Oh, you could do pelvic screws or femur screws. So your mind starts wandering. And I think the reality is, and just like I think the Intuitive is a great story, because the Intuitive robot, when it first came out, and Fred Moll was one of the inventors, who actually turns out was on our board of Excelsius before we sold to Globus. He's a visionary. This is the godfather of robotics and medicine. And, you know, really talked about focusing on your primary objective, which in this case was putting in a screw. And people criticize this. Well, why doesn't it do more? Okay, you've got to start off with something. And then to your point, once you've built that platform, you keep iterating to make that primary objective better. And then you start looking at other things, you know, whether it's deep brain stimulation or everything else. But that engineering support and focus on solving problems is what's really important. Globus has done an amazing job. They're really an engineering-focused company. David Ball, the founder, is an engineer and a visionary and able to sort of pull those pieces together. But from our standpoint, from early on, it's really about focusing on and solving all those problems as they come up, trying to maintain that focus, because if the primary objective doesn't work, nobody cares about anything else.
You know, that I think is a phenomenal point that perhaps a surgeon understands more than other people that might work with engineers about being focused on one thing at a time and both identifying and sticking to that objective. But talking about these iterative updates to the platform and these new exciting capacities and different things that you could do with the robot versus the one narrow focus you started with the robot. Again, to the extent that you can or want to talk about these things in a public venue, what's next? I was privileged enough to be in a room with you at the recent spine section meeting when you were talking about some of the new things coming down out of the lab. Where do you foresee both this platform and any other devices or technologies you might be working on with Globus in the near term?
So I think that obviously that everything becomes an evolution. I think we're really to the point now, the adoption of this technology has really been ridiculously, it's off the charts. And I think that surgeons are seeing value in this. The things I hear obviously are about other tasks that we do, whether it's osteotomies or placement of implants. We're now tracking implants, obviously, even lordotic implants with the robot to give us an understanding as we're putting in and altering the spine. I think, you know, the one would think that the logical next step would be adding in bone removal, being able to make surgical cuts in bone for osteotomies, removal of facets, performance of, you know, osteotomies for correction of deformity, laminectomies, whatever. And having, so there are robotic technologies now in the knee world, Mako, for example, where they have a no-fly zone where literally it's like coloring inside the box. The surgeon has outlined the extent of the bone removal for replacement of a knee, and he just drills and the robot confines him into that space. So that was a part of our original roadmap. And I will tell you that that's something obviously that can be done, requires additional time. Line of sight, in other words, where my head is blocking the tracker and then the robots, you know, all these things that are frustrating with the usage of image guidance are going to get better with new types of technology. So different ways of tracking, different ways of seeing where the robot is will be important. You know, potentially looking at other things that have gotten a lot of interest recently, which is for teaching and otherwise, the usage of augmented reality in spine surgery. So there's lots of different things which I could see coming together in the near future, bone removal being one of them, and then sort of understanding then in real time what we've done. I think one of the biggest shortfalls, especially in deformity surgery, is you're doing a big case and at the end, we're giving each other a high five, but we don't really have a great understanding of exactly what we've done.
Right.
And how do we do that? How do we make that better? So looking at potentially incorporating that into this entire workflow of image guidance and robotics, where we could get feedback in real time about how we did. What's the correction look like? Really, really, what's most important? How does this patient look when he stands up while he's still on the table? So we've all been disappointed, you know, after finishing an operation and having somebody stand up and it's not quite what you wanted. So utilizing what you have, which is all this robust information and registration and understanding what the spine looks like at the beginning of the case, utilize that information on the back end to help you have a really good understanding, not just at the end, but during the case, what needs to be done to make that correction.
Right. Well, Dr. Theodore, I think as we bring this conversation to a close, it would be remiss of me to not ask you a more, I guess you could say, philosophical question about the idea of robotics and spine surgery, simply because I have the godfather of robotics and spine surgery on the show here. And so I wonder if you could talk a bit about, in your view, what the role of robotics really is within our field. I think the analogy you made to cranial neurosurgical navigation is apt, and you're right. There's no tumor surgery that happens in the developed world, cranial tumor surgery, that doesn't have navigation on board, at least to plan the incision and the craniotomy, right? But on the other hand, when a trauma comes in with a subdural, we know how to use our knowledge of anatomy to not just be on the right side of the head, but the right region of the head, opening the right region of the skull where we know the hematoma is, for example. On the spine side of things, complex cuts, osteotomies, many levels of fusion to correct a deformity, that's one end of the spectrum here. But on the other end of the spectrum, if it's midnight and someone comes in with a spinal cord injury that we need to decompress, you know, we know how to do laminectomies and we don't really need or won't have a robot in the middle of the night to do that for us. So there clearly is some spectrum of where there's a role for navigation robotics in what we do and where we always will have to have the basic skills of spine surgeons, right? And so I wonder if with that in mind, and as you said before, the phrase enabling technology, right? Maybe you could just talk a bit about what that enabling technology phrase means to you and where you see the role of robotics in spine surgery now and perhaps in the coming decades.
That's another hour-long question, JP, but
right.
let me go ahead and try to distill that. I think at the end of the day, this technology is here. I don't think we as a specialty are going to go backwards. In other words, I don't think we're going to start abandoning things that potentially make us safer, faster, better. And that's an arguable point. And we're, you know, that's what's so exciting about the ongoing debate about all enabling technologies. What I see is a couple of things. First and foremost, from a resident standpoint, from a teaching standpoint, we can never lose sight of the anatomy. We have to understand the anatomy. We have to understand what we're doing and why we're doing it and what the anatomical structures are, et cetera. So we cannot ever be relegated to the point where a robot or any other device does surgery for us. We still want to be the surgeons. And that was my mantra from the very beginning. I said, I'm not trying to put myself out of business. I want to try to make my life easier, my life better. So from a teaching perspective, everybody has to know the anatomy. That's the most important thing. The next thing is, the reality is that when Michael Wang and I were residents, we didn't have work hour restrictions, and we spent thousands of hours learning to do what we do. And we don't have, JP, in your training, we've got work hour restrictions, we've got other things, and we've got a tremendously explosive amount of knowledge now in neurosurgery. If you think about what the neurosurgeon in residency has to know, endovascular, mm-hmm. open vascular, functional, peripheral nerve, spine, pediatrics, it's dizzying the amount of stuff people have to know. And then trying to specialize or know to do things. So certainly the basics, yes, doing a laminectomy in the middle of the night or a hemicraniectomy, yes, we don't need a robot, you should be able to do that. But I will tell you that, you know, from a trauma perspective, and that just segue in the last thing is that we're now, I mean, in the middle of the night, we do fire the robot up. We are able to get intraoperative image and percutaneously put pedicle screws in and decompress the spinal cord in a far less bloody field and in a shorter amount of time than I will tell you than you could do open by taking down all the tissues. So that things are going to meet. And the millennials, my residents in that age category, Gen Z to follow, they are the ones who are going to be clamoring for this because they understand, number one, they really are adept with technology. They're very easily understanding of technology. And they realize that there's going to be value. It's hard to learn everything else you need to learn. And certainly doing something open, doing a trauma case in somebody with a BMI of 70 at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's a disaster no matter what your situation. If you can collapse the time of that procedure and potentially do it with less blood loss and do part of it percutaneously, that can become a game changer. So I think it's the end of it is its evolution. And I think we're moving in that direction. I don't think we're going backwards.
Well, Dr. Theodore, those are great comments. And I totally agree with everything you're doing. You are moving the needle, as we say, making surgery safer, more accessible, and enabling procedures that, you know, don't even exist today. We're going to find out in the future. So thank you for coming on the podcast. We do have to have you back to talk about concussions, sports, military medicine, and spine in general. So thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for the opportunity, JP and Mike. I really appreciate it and really excited and proud of what you guys are doing because it's such a public service for not just neurosurgeons, but for everybody. I can't tell you how many people are listening to you, myself included.
Disclaimer time. The opinions and ideas expressed in this show are solely those of myself, Dr. Wang, and our guests. They do not represent the opinions of any professional institution or organization. This show is for entertainment purposes only and does not constitute the giving of medical or legal advice. Listening to or participating in this show does not constitute continuing medical education or any other professional certification. It's just a show, everybody.